on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Mark Kermode is in Japan this week, from where we'll be reviewing Night at the Museum 2, Away Days, Everlasting Moments, Tormented, and movies like that. Hello, Mark. Why are you there in the first place?
Well, because I'm not in Cannes. The thing everyone keeps saying to me is, why aren't you in Cannes? And I think it has been fairly well recorded that my record at Cannes is slightly troubled. And I think when I was at Radio 1 back in the 90s, and I did 5 years at Cannes, and the fifth year I went completely nuts, and I had a now vaguely infamous meltdown in the middle of that Lars von Trier film, The Idiots, in which I stood up and started shouting at the screen in very bad French and was thrown out onto the Croisette by the security guard.
What were you shouting?
Well, I can't repeat it, because although it was pidgin French, it would still be understandable to anybody who'd even done, you know, Monsieur la vie savait un chat un sanger un citron de cheveux. So anyway, but it wasn't, let's just say it wasn't good. And it was at least comprehensible enough for the security guard to throw me out. And so I've now, just in the last 4 years, I've done four or five years on the truck, and so I needed to have a year off. Plus, the Society of Cinema and Media Studies conference was happening out in Tokyo, which the boss, the professor, was giving a paper at. And then, of course, what happens is, last week it got cancelled because they decided that anybody from England was going to bring over swine flu. And then it got put back on again on the condition that everybody at the conference has their temperature taken on the way in and then does the whole conference wearing a face mask. Wow. And I'm not making this up. If you're delivering a lecture, you have to wear a face mask unless the whole of the front row is clear, in which case you can take the face mask off because it's figured that you can't spit to row two.
Could you do a mask like in V? One of those kind of
masks? Yeah, that would be great. I think I'd look very good in a V-like mask. Incidentally, thank you for reminding me, and I take the opportunity to say it once again, that V for Vendetta was the movie that was better than the more recent Alan Moore adaptation, Watchmen. V for Vendetta is the movie that everybody should have gone to see.
We got Steve Coogan with us, and it's a very important thing because we only get to speak to you, Steve. I mean, it's every couple of years. I think it was Cock and Bull Story, wasn't it, last time you were
on? Probably, yeah, probably.
But now we have Night at the Museum 2, and it's not in 3D, and we're part of a 3D debate here. Do you like movies in 3D?
Yes, it's enjoyable, but it depends what kind of movie it is. For example, I wouldn't like to see a Woody Allen movie in 3D, for example. That won't work for me.
Yes. Because there's Coraline in 3D. We've been discussing this quite a lot. I just have an interesting take on this from Jordan on this email. I'm just trying to think of a Night Museum 2 application for this email. Simon, I think I've stumbled across a better solution to 3D. On Friday night, I finally managed to see Let the Right One In. Have you seen that, Steve?
No.
Mark, your assessment of that movie, remind us?
It's the finest movie of the year, indeed of last year. It was the film that Sweden should have put forward as their entry for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, but they didn't, and more fool them.
Anyway, and Jordan says, midway through, I found myself getting slightly tense, and I realised that I was biting my lip, which resulted in bleeding, copious bleeding, for the remainder of the film. There is something strange about watching a vampire movie with a mouthful of your own blood. And it got me thinking about what else could I do on the cheap to further my movie-going experience? Eating raw meat during Dawn of the Dead or live squid during Old Boy or something like that. Anyway, I love the film, but my lip has been incredibly sore and swollen since then, so I can't recommend it without warning you that it does hurt. So I think we'll do this today. Stuff that you can do on the cheap during a movie which enhances your cinematic experience. For Night at the Museum 2, I'm just trying to think, Steve, what could people take in legally into this film which would enhance the movie pleasure from Night at the Museum 2? Costume?
I'm trying to think of all the things I'd like to say and all the things that Fox wouldn't like me to say.
Well, never mind Fox. Just tell us what you'd like to say. You are Steve Coogan, after all.
Well, I don't know. If it's cold, you could always, pee your pants. I mean, that would warm you up a bit. And I suppose anything that made you feel a little warmer would enhance the movie-going experience. I can't think of anything that's apposite to Night at the Museum. You could take a dinosaur in with you. And then I'm trying to think of the name of a celebrity who's obviously sort of faded from memory to fit in with that joke, but I can't be bothered.
Okay, well, anyway, I think other people via email, thank you, Jordan, for that. If you've had a similar kind of cinematic experience, get in touch. We'll do that between now and 4 o'clock. Bring us up to date on the plot developments that we need for Night at the Museum 2, Steve.
It does tell you an awful lot about history. Obviously, there's an incredible American slant to it, which these days is sort of you know, unavoidable. It deals with the sort of Air and Space Museum, just sort of moves things up a gear. There's a lot of special effects in it. And it's got photographs come to life. There's a sort of famous photograph of a D-Day in Times Square with like a serviceman kissing sort of a random woman in the street, and that comes to life. So they sort of play around with a lot of iconic imagery and use it as a jumping off point for various things. And Amelia Earhart, Amy Adams is sort of the new sort of addition to the cast, and some really good comic cameos. I think it's a definite improvement on the first one. It's funny, and I get a chance to do stuff in it with Owen Wilson, which was great fun, you know. And what else do you want to know?
Explain why you think it's better than the first one. Then
They're just better jokes, isn't it? That's all. There's a good cameo from what's his name? Is it Seth? Not Seth Rogen. What's the other one called? One of those new Tubby.
Jonah.
Joan, yeah, that's right, yeah, thank you, yeah.
voices off from Japan.
there's some nice little cameos in there, and there's some good comic performances, so I think it's better, you know, it's better and slightly bigger, and you know, I think people like the first one, they'll like the second one.
Yes, and you're reprising Octavius.
Yeah, and myself and Owen Wilson sort of developed this kind of double act, and fortunately, Sean Levy allows us enough rope to hang ourselves or otherwise. So we're kind of able to embellish things within the sort of huge gargantuan behemoth that is a big Hollywood movie.
Yes,
you get a little chance to do some improv, and that's always good fun, and it sort of lifts what's on the page.
Because it's so CGI-tastic, it's difficult to know who's actually there with the other actors at a particular time, but it sounds as though the bit that you enjoyed the most is actually when you are actually acting together and making stuff as you go along.
Yeah, well, Owen and I did actually we were physically in the same space together a lot, which is great because he's a lot of fun. He's smart and he's intelligent and he's funny, so he's good company, and you try and think on your feet, and it makes you it's easier to make more of an effort in trying to be inventive when you've got someone opposite you who sort of acts as a kind of a, you know, reciprocates the sort of the input that you're making, whatever it is you're doing. So he's a good partner to work with. He's fun, he's smart, you know.
And his cowboy character and your Roman character, they seem to like each other increasingly as the movie progresses.
Yeah, well, we kind of I don't know if I was supposed to say this, but obviously I think any literary critique of the movie may find some sort of deep
homoerotic theme.
Homoerotic, sort of subtext to their relationship. But that's only my own opinion.
Right, we'll hear from Mark on this in just a moment. Let's play you a clip. Here's a little bit from Night at the Museum 2.
Good to see you, lad.
Yeah, you too, Teddy. Hey, fellas. How you doing?
Well, looky here. If it ain't Mr. Big in the britches himself. Come back just in time to see us off.
We're gonna be okay here.
We? You hear that? You hear Daydream Johnny? There ain't been a we ever since you put us on the pay no mind list. And that's a cold place to be, boy.
Larry, what's done is done. Even the glory of Rome had to come to an end.
Would you please not look dramatically off into the middle distance when you say that? It makes me feel worse.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Where are you looking? Where are you looking? I'm over here.
That was very Ralph Richardson, I thought.
Yeah, it's just a voice number 23 that I drag out for these occasions.
Night at the Museum 2 is actually open yesterday. Mark, take it away, sir.
Well, I mean, I think it's terribly uneven, but I think, as Steve said, it basically, you know, it's a great big Hollywood movie which has lots of cameos, and every individual bit of it is only as funny as the individual comedians on stage. I don't think with anyone, you know, in their right mind would argue that it has much of a story. I think it is a collection of bits, and there are bits of it that I enjoyed more than other bits. I'm a huge fan of Steve's. I think Cock and Bull Story and 24 Hour Party People were absolutely wonderful films. And so from my point of view, you know, the way I'd enjoy the movie more is taking in a DVD of those two things and watching them for all the bits that Steve's not on screen. But, you know, it's sort of it is what it is. I mean, it is a sequel that's, in my film critic mind, is defined by the fact that the first movie took $571 million worldwide, so you kind of can't not do another one. But it is a collection of bits, and some of the bits are funnier than the other bits. I happen to find Steve funny. I
violently agree.
Yeah, well, there we go. So, but I think Steve, you know, even as you were saying when you described it by saying, well, it is a big Hollywood movie. This is what you can do within the terms of that. And I think honestly, anyone who's involved in those things knows that that's what they are. Nobody is going to argue that it's a great movie.
Well, it's sort of like it's what I do. It's like when I do big parts in small movies and small parts in big movies, and that's sort of what I've ended up doing. And you do something like that, and you kind of. I've just done another movie that based on these Percy Jackson things where I play the devil in. As an actor, you have your little moment, and it's just something where you sort of you go and you have your moment. You either score in your moment or you don't. And to look at it in a sort of cynical fashion, you sort of see the thing where you go, where agents say, whatever movie you do, if you can be funny in your bit, it doesn't matter what the rest of the movie is like because you'll still have a career.
But are you hoping to do more, when I say the word acting, this is straight acting, as opposed to putting in a comedy turn, which is what the UK audience might expect, Steve?
Well, it depends what I'm doing. I mean, Cock and Bull Story and 24 Hour Party People wasn't me putting in a comic turn, although there were funny moments in it. It was just, you know, that I trained as an actor. I got I get a little bit straight-jacketed in the UK. Fortunately, in the US, there are sort of more auteur-type directors, you know, like Jim Jarmusch and Sofia Coppola and... the only person in Britain who's patronised me in the nicest possible way in that regard is Michael Winterbottom. In the US, I tend to be seen as this sort of interesting character actor from Britain, whereas over here, I am, for better or worse, mostly Alan Partridge. So that kind of...
quite frustrating, really?
It's something which is it's a nice problem to have because the alternative is not to have the kind of success that brings that problem at all. So I'm quite philosophical about it, and I do, you know, I've enjoyed the success I've had with it. But it does mean that if I want to do more interesting work, bizarrely, the kind of auteur type directors who are more inclined to offer me work are over there.
But if we take it as read that you're as funny as Ricky Gervais, what, you know, you could be leading a Hollywood movie. I mean, is it difficult to take that next step?
No, I did do one. It's just that people you have to have. I did a movie called Hamlet 2 that I was very pleased with that didn't do the numbers. You know, you do a movie like that. I did a movie in America. It got great hype at Sundance. Was bought for a record amount by Fox Searchlight. Focus. Focus Features. Yeah, and they and no one went to see it. So it doesn't. And it's all based on the if you're going to do a movie that's it's about, you know, it's about what the numbers are. So I'm getting those things, and they have their moment in the sun in the US, but they don't quite make it over here. So
Mark has a particularly incisive question. I can just feel it coming.
Well, no, just to follow up on that point, it is absolutely true that what happens is people make movies, and whether or not the movies get seen by a wide audience is often nothing to do with whether or not the movies are any good. I mean, you can be pretty much guaranteed that next week at the top of the box office in Britain is going to be Night at the Museum 2, and it's frankly not a very good film. And meanwhile, other stuff...
Well, hang on. Earlier on, you didn't say that. Your opinion's getting worse as we go through.
My opinion is exactly... my opinion is that it is a series of bits, and some of the bits are good, and
some of the
bits are
not. Well, first of all, you said it is what it is, and now you're saying it's not a very good film.
And what I said was, it is what it is, which is a sequel which exists because the first movie took so much money. Now, to follow up on what Steve was saying, the fact is there are other movies that are made that are far better that don't get seen. And it's very difficult for anybody, because if you're an actor rather than director, you're not actually in control. I mean, the best thing you can hope for is either that directors find in you the thing that is really good, or that you can find projects that bring out the best in you. I actually think that in terms of Steve's work with Michael Winterbottom, I referred before to Cock and Bull Story. One of the brilliant things about Cock and Bull Story is not only is it terrifically acted and actually an incredibly intelligent adaptation of a really complex book, But it addresses exactly the thing that Steve's talking about, which is his public perception and the perception of the character within the book, which come together. And that is a profoundly clever, postmodern, intelligent movie. But I guarantee you, for every one person that saw that, 100 will see Night at the Museum too. Yeah.
It's funny. When I do... it's bizarre that I have two audiences. I have the audience, a very mainstream audience that expects sort of more sort of obvious things from men, and this sort of slightly other intelligent audience, almost a schizophrenic audience. And when I do my live show, I made a couple of references to Michael Winterbottom. The audience who come to see my live show have no idea who Michael Winterbottom is, have no idea that I've done movies with him. I wouldn't know a Michael Winterbottom movie if they fell over it. But they want to hear kind of a vaudevillian type comedy, which is what I provide them in that live context. But I sort of quite... And I used to make a joke about Michael Winterbottom in the show every night. It never got a laugh, but I refused to take it out. So I continue to do the joke just for my own self-satisfaction and for the one time that Michael Winterbottom attended the show.
Can you keep it in? Because the next time I'm in the show, I'll be the guy laughing at the back, OK?
Steve, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks.
Why were you giving me such a hard time about saying, you know, that Night at the Museum 2 isn't such a great movie, but I like Steve Coogan? Because it was a...
Was getting worse the longer the conversation went on, and I felt if it had gone on 10 minutes longer, you'd have told us all that you hated it.
No. What I said right at the very beginning, and what I continued to say was, when I say it is what it is, and it is a film which exists because of the money that the original one took, and I have to say, I think Steve Coogan took it on the chin. I think he knows that that's the case, and I think, as he said himself, if his bit is funny, then it's all right. Then the rest of it doesn't kind of matter. But I can't lie to him. I can't suddenly tell him that I think it's a better movie than I do think it is, because I don't. You saw it, right?
Have you been drinking beer?
No. What did you think of it?
Just because it's five. What did I think? I thought it was exactly the same. I thought it. It is exactly the same as the first one. But I think there are a couple of moments where he's right. The jokes are funny. I mean, that clip that we played.
With
him in it, where Ben Stiller says, don't do that looking
off.
Oh, that was funny. You know, there are a couple of very funny bits in it.
But that bit is funny because it's Steve Coogan being funny. And that's actually a joke that Steve Coogan could have done in almost any movie. That's what I'm saying. So at any time, the movie is only as good as the person who's actually on screen.
We should have mentioned Hank Azaria, actually, who plays this evil Egyptian Pharaoh wants to take over the world, but for all the world, his voice is somewhere. He's good, particularly famous in this country, I think, for doing loads of the voices on The Simpsons. But his voice is somewhere between Michael Palin and
Broderick.
Yes, and Biggest Dickus.
Yeah, so, it absolutely is, and he is the person who steals the show. And of course, he's not, you know, in the original. And also, it's funny because Amy Adams, whose name Steve forgot, Amy Adams plays Amelia Earhart. And there's a funny thing when she says, "This is how I talk," and you go, "No, that's not how Amelia Earhart talks. You're doing Katharine Hepburn, doing Lady Cynthia Darrington in that, you know, 1930s film Christopher Strong." It was either a very very literate movie gag or a very strange reference to have made in the. But that's symptomatic of the film. Everyone's sort of been set free to do their own thing, and they do their own bit. And depending on how funny you find each individual person and element, that's how funny the movie is at that moment. But 5 minutes later, it'll be a completely different film, because in the end, it's totally incoherent.
Did it make you want to go out and buy a pair of jodhpurs for Mrs. Kermode?
No, not in the slightest. What it did make me want to do is to sit down with a bunch of people, you know, making films in Hollywood and say, can you please, you know, stop doing death of narrative cinema and stop doing a series of sketches and do something which is coherent? I mean, the other funny thing about it is as well, which is worth mentioning since we're on the subject now, I was going to review this later on, but since we've started, is that Ricky Gervais turns up very prominently on the poster. But, of course, as far as the movie's concerned, he turns up at the first 5 minutes of the movie and then he disappears, and he turns up at the last 5 minutes of the movie, because the story of the film is that at the beginning of the movie, it's the classic, you know, sequel thing, we have to move it on somewhere. So Ben Stiller's now successful. He comes back, he finds the museum is being closed and everything is being put into storage in Washington. So there's the travelogue bit. And then Ricky Gervais turns up at the beginning, says, yes, it's going to Washington. Then they go to Washington, they do a bunch of stuff, they come back, and Ricky Gervais turns up and says, oh, you're back. And for that, he's on the poster. It's very peculiar.
That's because he's Ricky Gervais.
No, I know, but that, again, seemed to me to be symptomatic of the problem, that somebody who's very prominently displayed is really only there in order to be present. So it's that strange... It's like an old 70s movie. Look, we've got all the old cast back. We've got some new characters as well, but essentially we've got all the old cast back. It's like a kind of... It's like a variety show. It's not a film... It's like a variety show. So, you know, I like the third act and I like the seventh act, but I could do without the juggling monkeys in the middle.
But you suspect that there might be a third one, because this will be a successful follow-up.
Well, on the basis of the first one taking the staggering money that it did, and I mean, it was interesting when Steve said, look, it's better than the first one. And I thought I heard in his tone, and maybe it's just me being cynical, the same, you know, the reaction that I have, which is that the first one really wasn't very funny at all. And so therefore this is funnier in as much as there are more jokes in it and there are more jokes that are funny, whereas with the first one, which just sort of felt terribly flat to me. But I never really understood the success of the first one.
Isn't that your job as film critic?
No, well, my job as film critic is to say, look, there are much better movies, and this you have to understand this. This film only exists because of the box office of the first film, and it is bitty in the extreme. And you're quite right. I mean, Hank Azaria does absolutely steal the show, and he is funny. I mean, oddly enough, Christopher Guest is in the movie, and I got to the end of the film going, where's Christopher Guest? And, of course, it turns out he was Ivan the Terrible.
Yes, which you don't actually realise right to the end.
Well, you don't realise it. Plus, he's not really in it very much, but his name is promptly displayed at the beginning. So it's almost like the aim of the movie, the casting of the movie was the movie itself. Look, we've got everybody, and we've got, Jonah Hill, who comes on for 5 minutes and does a five-minute routine. Actually, funnily enough, I thought his routine was quite funny, and he's the guy that I'm not a big fan of because I don't like films like Superbad. But it's just bits, and in the end, that doesn't make a film. It makes a variety show.
And look out for the singing cherubs played by the Jonas Brothers, most excitingly for listeners of a certain age.
In 3D, next week, we're going to be seeing and talking about the Jonas Brothers. What did that noise mean?
Oh, the Jonas Brothers, that's what it was for. Oh.
Do you really hate the Jonas Brothers?
Well, I don't really hate them because I quite like, you know, the film, to use your phrase, it is what it is. It's in 3D.
It's the Jonas Brothers.
And then I spoke to them and I found it a life-shortening experience. You know, we were offered a lot longer than I wanted to take, which is usually, you know, it's the opposite of like Steve Coogan. If you had him for 15 minutes, it would have been interesting to speak to him for half an hour. So box office top 10, here we go. At 10, it's 17 again, Zac Efron.
Well, Zac Efron has been better, and I prefer him in the High School Musical movies. And but it's passable. It's passable, 12-rated fare, but it's really not one of my favourite Zac Efrons.
Monsters vs. Aliens, this week's number 9.
So I went again. I took the kids to see it in 3D, and because I cannot get the 3D thing out of my head, the question of whether or not 3D really, you know, is something that we all have to grow used to. And I saw it again, a second time round. It worked just about as well as it did the first time. Actually, I stayed till the end of the credits this time, and there was an end gag which I hadn't realised before. There's actually quite a funny end gag about the president asking for coffee and doing something terrible, which I hadn't seen the first time round, so I was actually quite keen to get out of the cinema. But I sat there the whole thing thinking, is it going to be, you know, is it actually better in 3D? And at the end of the film, I asked both my kids, was it better because it was 3D? And they both said yes, and then I explained to them why they were wrong in the car on the way home.
I'm sure that was, oh, here we go. That was must have been a great moment for them.
Yeah, they love it.
Here goes Dad boring us to tears about 3D again. State of Play today.
I mean, I can't think of State of Play without thinking of the thing that David Morrissey said about he can't go to see it because it would be like going to the wedding of an old girlfriend that he was still in love with. And funnily enough, although I liked the film when I saw it, that terribly poignant image of David Morrissey standing around outside, you know, with his tie maybe slightly adrift, wondering whether he should go in, but worrying about the heartbreak is just sticking with me so much I can't enjoy the film anymore.
The Ghost of Girlfriend's Past is at number 7.
Features a poster of Mr. Mahogany leaning jovially and comically against someone.
That's what he does. That's he leans better than anyone else.
And that is the film in a nutshell.
Fighting's at 6.
Which I quite liked. I mean, you interviewed the main guy.
Channing Tatum.
You liked him. You said he was a southern gentleman in the manner of Elvis.
He was very nice. I was hoping the Jonas Brothers might be a bit like Channing Tatum, but it turned out that they weren't.
No. But I think there are sort of shades of Saturday Night Fever. That don't mean for one minute that it compares to Saturday Night Fever, so please don't put that on the poster. But that sense of that there are fight sequences interspersed with quite gritty, quite, downbeat, genuinely believable character scenes works out quite well. So I thought it was perfectly fine.
And then we have Hannah Montana, the movie, at number 5.
Starring Smiley Virus, as Stephen Fry called her. And I seem to have a soft spot for this movie that others perhaps don't share. I mean, I do think, on the one hand, clearly it's part of a kind of evil corporate takeover of the world, and fine, I understand that. But hey, you know, as for what it was, I thought it did the job perfectly well. And if you're a young girl, wants to go watch a Hannah Montana movie, I think it's a perfectly fine Hannah Montana movie.
X-Men Origins: Wolverine at 4.
So on the other hand, if you're a young man, you want to go and see the Wolverine movie. Why? It's, you know, actually that's the comparison, right? Hannah Montana, fine, perfectly fine movie. Wolverine, total mess of a film. So I think actually the Hannah Montana movie is better than X-Men Wolverine, and I would stand by that decision.
We have Coraline at number three. An email here somewhere. There it is. It's Kieran. BA honours. History. Dear Wolverine and Sabretooth, I've been to Coraline and I personally found it to be an enjoyable gothic film, the best film I've seen in the cinema since Slumdog, but I personally found it difficult to put the 3D glasses over my regular glasses.
Yes, that is a problem.
My viewing pleasure. Did The Good Doctor have a similar issue? I also thought the 3D didn't add much to the story.
I think it is a problem. Funnily enough, I when I went to see, not Fly Me to the Moon, I went to see some 3D movie a couple of years ago, and I put the 3D glasses on over my glasses, and it scratched the front of my glasses, which was really bad. So then I went and got contact lenses for, if I had to see a 3D movie, I have to put contact lenses in, because it's really not good putting them over the front of your glasses, because it does scratch them, and that is an ongoing problem. I like Coraline very much. I was particularly entertained by the fact that many British critics said it was far too scary for a kids' movie, and yet the fact is kids are enjoying it enormously, so I think it's just far too scary for film critics.
Kieran also says on his email, the trailer for the new Guy Ritchie film is out on the internet and it looks bad.
But
on the
this is Sherlock Holmes, yeah?
And just before the Night in the Museum 2, I saw the new trailer for the next Harry Potter film, which is very exciting. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I've seen the... What are they calling it? HP... Is it 6 or 7?
It's HP6.
HP6.
That's what it'll be. And looks very good as well. Star Trek's at number 2. What?
Go on. No, I was going to say Star Trek 2.0 or Star Trek Smallville, the early years. And I really liked it, and they've totally reinvigorated the series for me, and they've reinvented both the past and the future. And I think it's a really good... I'd much rather Star Trek movies were like this. I mean, this reminded me of The Voyage Home, which was easily the best of the Star Trek movies, and it had lost all that sense of ponderous portentousness and was back to being zippy and fun and satirical.
George in Bahrain says, "Dear Gregory, Dorothy and Susan," which is slightly confusing. "The latest Star Trek movie, enjoyable romp, good balance of action, plot development and comic moments. However, with the budgets these blockbuster movies have, as well as their ability to make the impossible possible through special effects, CGI and so on, why did Spock, the older genuine article, have such ill-fitting dentures? Should I look forward to the..."
Those aren't dentures. Those are his teeth.
"Should I look forward to the director's cut DVD, which will include reference to Spock's mother's affair with Freddie Parrotface Davis, who hasn't been referred to on any network for a very long time. This would give a far more logical explanation of Spock's ears than this Vulcan nonsense."
It is a weird thing. Those are clearly Leonard Nimoy's teeth, and clearly he has one of those faces in which he's had all his teeth straightened and made perfect in the way that some Americans do, and then the rest of his face has aged around his teeth, but his teeth haven't aged. I mean, that is one of the weird things about perfect teeth, is that there's one part of your face that stays exactly the same. I mean, obviously I wouldn't know because I have the worst British teeth in the world.
Chris...
I was going to say that's Leonard Nimoy's problem. Too much dentistry, Your Majesty.
Chris in Colchester, "Dear Spock and Kirk, just wanted to say I saw this Star Trek movie on Tuesday with my wife and 6-month-old son. He seemed oblivious to its charms, but we loved it. All the other summer blockbusters returned to base immediately for emergency refits." And Angels and Demons is the UK's number one movie this week.
The thing I can't believe that I didn't point out in my review that several people then wrote into the... my BBC blog saying, it's amazing, having complained in the whole of the first movie about turn the lights on, turn the lights on, turn the lights on, what you didn't point out was that the greatest contrivance of Angels and Demons is that one of the parts of the plot is that they find this way of turning the lights off in sections of the city one by one. So it says, oh no, we have to find this bomb. Here is a television camera looking at it. How will we find out whereabouts in the city it is? I know. Let's systematically turn the lights off in various parts of the city. And when the light goes off in the camera that's looking at the bomb, we'll know that that's where it is, which basically gives them a plot excuse for turning the lights off.
That's the box office top 10. We have some new movies to consider, as well as... The Night at the Museum 2, which we've kind of done, but may we'll be returning to that.
Can I just...
A lot of
one
people,
other thing.
What,
a historic, what? Very quickly, a historical point. Night at the Museum 2, when Steve Coogan was saying that the photographs come to life, and he said that there's that very famous photograph of the serviceman kissing the woman in Times Square.
Yes.
And he said it was D-Day. Surely not D-Day. Surely VJ Day or VE Day.
Thanks for that. Giles Mitchell. I haven't seen Doctor yet, but I've got my eyes peeled. I want to take him out to the karaoke. It is Friday night in Tokyo.
Yeah, but the problem with karaoke is that, as was demonstrated by Lost in Translation, actually from the hotel I'm in, you can see the hotel that Lost in Translation was in. The moment that I knew that Lost in Translation had lost the plot was the moment when they go to the karaoke bar, because that is always the last resort of the story having run out of steam.
Ben, on this email, this is Ben Lamb at Hull University, on the subject of film trilogies where each instalment is progressively better.
Oh, yes.
Which we touched lightly and daintily on last week, but we didn't dwell on the matter.
No.
If we are speaking, says Ben, in terms of vision, imagination and hilarity, then surely Sam Raimi's Evil Dead is a worthy contender. The first is a classic, the second is an improvement on the same material. But
the third is a dog.
Bruce Campbell in the English Middle Ages as a godlike time traveller beats the other two right out of the water.
No, it doesn't. And here's I'm sorry, this is something that's going to make me really, really cross. Evil Dead 1, great. Obviously great. Evil Dead 2, really interesting, because essentially the same movie made with more money but manages to be somehow slightly greater. Evil Dead 3, which should have been the medieval Dead, then ended up being Army of Darkness, which is a PG-13 rated piece of piffle. And when Bruce Campbell was on the program, you know, we had it out on the subject of I was really cross. And in fact, I reviewed Army of Darkness for Fangoria and got a bunch of hate mail from horror fans saying, "How dare you, bad!" But it's true, that film is a mess. In all three endings of it are a mess.
However, he also says, this is Ben Lamb still at Hull University, George Romero's zombie trilogy, he would like to put in here. Night of the Living Dead was a superb nihilistic horror tapping into the anxieties of a 1970s America. Dawn of the Dead upped the ante to create the greatest politically aware action film of all time. But Romero managed to excel in the sub-genre he single-handedly created when it came to Day of the Dead. With all the characters confined to one room, it is three times as scary, tense and inventive. Most trilogies run out of steam by their third installment when they maximise the budget and minimise the talent, but Romero did neither.
It's a good call. I still think that Dawn of the Dead is a superior film, again, in both its versions. But and then again, I mean, Night of the Living Dead is such a milestone. It's hard to think of Day of the Dead as being somehow more important than Night of the Living Dead.
A number of people have suggested the Back to the Future trilogy, but I think two dips in the middle and then three is as good as one.
Yeah, no, that's definitely that follows the High School Musical rule. One, great. Two, three, better.
That's the High School Musical rule, is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
What can you fit in 3.5 minutes?
See, I want to do Away Days, but I want to give that a little bit more time. So let's talk very quickly in that case about the Swedish movie that was... I complained earlier on. We were talking about Let the Right One In, OK? When Let the Right One In wasn't put forward as Sweden's entry for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, they put forward this film called Everlasting Moments. And it was a very interesting, you know, battle. The question was whether or not Let the Right One In actually had opened too late to be eligible. A number of people just assumed, and I have to admit that I was one of them, that the reason they hadn't put Let the Right One In forward was because it was a horror movie, it was a vampire movie, it was the kind of movie that would be improved, as the listener pointed out, by biting your own lip and bleeding whilst watching it, as opposed to Everlasting Moments, which is much more in the kind of mode of an Oscar-winning movie. It's a very sort of moving story about a long-suffering wife of a handsome labourer in turn-of-the-century Sweden. And at the beginning of their relationship, there's a camera, one in a competition. One of them has it. The other one says, "You can only share it with me if you marry me." And they get married. The labourer then grows up and becomes, you know, a handsome, philandering drunkard who regularly goes home and beats his wife. The wife, meanwhile, suffers an awful lot until one day she pulls the camera out and takes it to a camera shop in the hope of pawning it. And the guy who runs the camera shop says, no, you must go away and use this camera. And through using the camera, she discovers somehow a window onto another world, possibly a window into her own soul, but also a window onto the rest of the world. And she develops this extraordinary talent for photography. She keeps regularly trying to get rid of the camera because of what the camera does about opening up her soul. Actually, there's one beautiful moment when she tries to take the camera back to the shop. She says, "I can't have the camera anymore because the camera makes me forget that I am a mother and a wife." And it's a very, very moving and very absorbing and very interesting piece of cinema. I have to say that at the beginning of it, I was kind of rather agin it because I was so much a champion of Let the Right One In. I really thought that should have been put forward for the Oscars. There is a weird possibility that Let the Right One In might actually be eligible for next year, which would seem very peculiar, although apparently there was a case with City of God in which City of God was up for Best Foreign Language Film 1 year, and then the director was up for Best Director next year. So it's not impossible. Some critics critics have made comparison between the central figure here and the figure of Vera Drake. And there is a similar sense of a woman out of time, a woman being completely surrounded by a society which doesn't really have a place for her to express herself. It is a film which requires a degree of patience on behalf of the audience, but it is really, you know, moving and powerful and engaging. I just think the problem is that when you put it next to something like Let the Right One In, it's good as opposed to brilliant. And if what you want is something which is really sort of solidly made, beautifully photographed, and is actually about that idea that the camera can take a moment and make it last forever, hence the title, then I think you'll find something in it. It is a fine piece of film, and there is real melancholy beauty in it, even though it is very slow and it does require patience. The kind of film that you're not, you know, you want to go and see if you feel like you've got 2 hours to give your full attention to something which is going to require you to make the effort.
Night at the Museum 2 does indeed include that photo that you were talking about. Is VJ Day, number of listeners.
Hey!
Mark is indeed right on that. And Robin in Edinburgh says, hi, old jock and Greyfriars Bobby. Times Square photo wasn't VJ Day. It was also a staged photo. And
oh, was it?
Real
okay.
One at all. Dear Che Guevara and the revolutionary Kit Kat. I think I'll be the Kit Kat. This is Tom in Sheffield. Went to see Coraline, brilliant film, but could do without the 3D, as when we saw it, the projector was broken, had to be rebooted several times. This meant we saw the Jonas Brothers trailer 5 times
least,
which was like being stuck in a hideous Groundhog Day-style time loop, which I thought would never, ever end. Stop 3D, says Tom, but I think he might be slightly prejudiced by the fact that he had to watch the Jonas Brothers, which we will discuss in 3D on next week's programme. A number of people just want to pick up on a few of the Star Trek points, which we were discussing earlier. Tom in Worcestershire. Dear Kirk and Khan, would the good dogs please explain to me how Star Trek could be regarded as a good film, as it has 2 major plot flaws. One, the meeting in the ice cave between 2 of the main characters, such an incredible coincidence that dictates the rest of the film and reveals the whole plot in 2 minutes. 2, the drill. They don't need this to mine into the core to detonate the red matter, as it gets blown up in the end in a normal collision. Why bother with it, except to get a good action scene put in there? It annoys me so much to see obvious holes in films that are regarded as great, and it puts the Doctor's PhD to shame.
The meeting in the ice cave has now kind of become a convention of this. I mean, it's one of the things that happens in Star Wars. If 2 people are dropped on the same planet, they will inevitably meet in a cave. I mean, it doesn't matter how big the planet is. And that kind of dates back to, I suppose, the great traditions of Blake 7 and Doctor Who, where any 2 people on a planet will automatically bump it. They'll say, oh, it's a long wait, and then they'll bump into each other after about 5 minutes. And there's just nothing you can do about that. It is just a sci-fi convention. As far as the drilling thing is concerned, I don't understand why do they not have to... Because actually...
Here's another thing on the drilling. This is Andrew in Edinburgh, PhD in stochastic processes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scientifically, he says, the Romulans hang their drill down over San Francisco, but it would only hang over the same spot in geosynchronous orbit over the equator. So unless they move San Francisco, it can't happen.
See, I thought the drilling was actually a reference to the Dalek Invasion Earth movie, in which the Daleks drill the middle of the Earth out in order to turn the Earth into a big spaceship.
No, that doesn't really... As you know, as an explanation, that's a bit rubbish, isn't it?
Well, it's Star Trek. I mean, you know, what's more rubbish is the fact that, you know, that everyone around the universe understands the same language. Which recently in Doctor Who, incidentally, they explained by the TARDIS suddenly having a magical translating facility.
Ben in London, dear Dr. Emil Schuffhausen and Ruprecht the Monkey Boy, which one are you?
I'll be Ruprecht the Monkey Boy. I'm not sure who either of those are.
No, well, it's fun. This is about ways to make the cinematic experience more real.
Oh, yes.
Because we, a while back, had an email from someone who went to see Let the Right One In with a mouthful of blood and found that this sort of enhanced the cinematic experience. I once tried to match with nail, drink for drink, which resulted in a very predictable crash after about 1 hour once the lighter fluid kicked in.
That is a game.
Yes.
There is the with nail drinking game, which is very dangerous.
I didn't cover myself in deep heat, but wouldn't discourage others from giving it a go. But anyway, in general, that's not a wise thing to be
I mean, there is this whole gag which is on the internet for ages about the with nail drinking game. But it is true that if you do the with nail drinking game and you actually do drink what with nail drinks on screen, you will die.
So I think we've been warned.
Yes.
Max, on this email, dear Marlo and Kurtz, in a moment of, again, enhancing the movie experience, and with some very bad weather predicted over Bank Holiday Monday in some parts of the country, you might like to try this. In a moment of weirdly marvellous synchronicity, I sat down to watch Twister. Just as a massive rumble of thunder broke outside, as the film progressed, storm clouds rolled in, lightning flashed, rain pounded the window, thunder boomed and echoed throughout, giving me one of the most intense, immersive film experiences that I've ever had. So line up Twister if you've got some bad weather coming on Monday afternoon, and you'll have a most glorious time.
If you go and see Angels and Demons, if while it's playing you drum your head lightly on the chair in front of you,
yes,
it probably makes it seem slightly less annoying.
Tell us about Away Days, Doctor.
Yeah, now, so adapted from Kevin Sampson's novel. You had him on the programme, didn't you? The novelist, Kevin Sampson, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Fine, but
it was on Tuesday.
Big impression.
It was on Tuesday, and I wasn't doing the show on Tuesday.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, I wasn't. I was over here anyway. So, adapted from his novel, and the first time I heard about Away Days, it was last year. The LFF did a panel discussion about violence in movies, and they were talking to Richard Jobson was there talking about Newtown Killers, and there was the director of a film called Johnny Mad Dog about which is a very, very tough film, and Away Days, and which gave me the sense that it's a movie about football violence, and I have a big problem with films about football violence. Because actually, aside from Alan Clark's The Firm, they tend to be all a little bit, you know, Football Factory and all a little bit Green Street. And actually, from the outside, Away Days looked worryingly like Green Street, which I really didn't like at all. Because the story is that there's a young guy who's got an art school dropout. He's absolutely in love with the idea of football hooligan culture. He meets up with a guy who's within that culture, says, come on, let me be part of your gang. The guy doesn't want him to be part of the gang at first and explains to him all the reasons why he can't, but he effectively then inveigles his way in and becomes part of this culture, which he is completely outside. Let's hear a clip.
Still can't go to the game with you in the pack, though, can I? No choices there, eh?
Oh, mate, just leave it out, yeah? Take it from one who knows. You do not belong there.
Right. And that mong in the park, eh? He's not even from round here.
Robbie?
Yeah, him.
He may be a bit of a subby, Robbie, but he's our subby. Do you know? He belongs.
Right, sir, no, I know.
It really means that much to you?
Yeah. More than you could ever imagine.
Okay, then.
You'll take me?
Better can head north. 12 bells, Saturday.
Saturday?
Yeah, Saturday. Like, it's generally when footy matches happen, you know?
Gotcha.
And so he then becomes part of the gang that he's trying to inveigle his way into. And here's what's interesting, is that despite my sort of preconceptions about it, as I said, partly because of the circumstance in which I'd heard about the film before, and despite the fact that it features that kind of now time-honoured slow-motion shot of the gang of hooligans walking slowly towards the camera, with the camera picking up on the details of what they're wearing, which to some extent we've seen in This Is England, and of course actually ultimately refers back to that infamous shot from A Clockwork Orange. So it's actually very little about football violence. I mean, there are, you know, violent rock scenes in it that are convincingly done, but actually what it's about is, you know, that the pop music culture and the fashion culture at the end of the 70s, you know, breaking into the beginning of the 80s, as you probably guessed from that clip, it's set in Liverpool. And it's closer in many ways to This Is England than it is to something like Green Street. The soundtrack is packed with things like Joy Division and Echo and the Bunnymen and Magazine. I mean, obviously, no Comsat Angels, but we can't have everything. And the dialogue is much more about people spouting Camus than you know, worrying about league tables. And the things I liked about it were this. Firstly, it is a very good evocation of a particular time. I mean, it has a real melancholic sense of that, you know, the post-punk era, and it's very, very good at capturing a time which most of us remember but is now obviously kind of, you know, lost in the mist of time. It also is essentially a love story about the two central characters. I mean, despite it's really odd because it seemed to me that this is very, very clear that this is what the film is. And actually the film itself seems to state this very openly, that the guy who's in with the football culture is also he has, you know, let's say, personal issues. He has a noose hanging from his ceiling, which he says he's put there to remind me of the ultimate, you know, pointlessness of life. And it is clear that he is in love with our hero. And it is also clear that our hero is sort of in love with him in a way which is never specifically stated. So it's a poignant sort of love story. It's a very good evocation of that period. It's all shot on film stock that looks like it was actually around at the time. Funnily enough, I've read some of the reviews of it have said, oh, it looks unbelievably murky. It doesn't look murky. It looks absolutely of the period. You know when people say jokingly that there are certain periods of history that took place in black and white and there are certain periods of history that took place in sepia? It's like if you got in a time machine and went back to the beginning of World War II, it would be in black and white. Well, there is something about, I mean, I'm not a camera technician, obviously. There is something about the film stock and the way the film has been processed that gives the look of a Way Days exactly the right period feel. A look which goes absolutely with the Joy Division soundtrack, with the Echo and the Bunnymen soundtrack, with the magazine soundtrack. It really captured that very well. I mean, I remember that period. I was, you know, in Manchester in the early 1980s and spent a lot of time going into Liverpool. And funnily enough, I knew a guy who was very similar to one of the central characters in this film. And it rang true to me. I think it would be very easy to look at the film and to think of it as being about football violence, which I think it absolutely isn't, although that is a part of what it's about. It was much more melancholic than that, much more nostalgic than that, much more moving than that. I thought it was very, very well played. And I have to say, having gone in with some fairly negative preconceptions, I came out of it solidly impressed. I mean, there are things about it that I find, you know, worrying and alarming, because essentially I find all football hooliganism absolutely terrifying and repugnant. But I do think that the film goes beyond that and is about a sort of unspoken love affair between these two blokes that is set in a period of time which is beautifully captured.
Are you sure you haven't spotted a homoerotic undercurrent where actually there isn't one?
But it's not an undercurrent. The thing is, it's clearly not an undercurrent. It's almost...
Is it a growing swell?
No, it's almost an overcurrent. It's almost declared. I mean, it's the thing about subtext and supertext. It's bizarre because It's just so apparent that that's what it is that it almost seems to me there's no point in saying that's what it is. But earlier on today, I had a conversation with somebody else from Radio 5 who said, did you think that's what it was? And I went, well, of course that's what it is. How can it be about anything else?
Well, you spotted something. Maybe it doesn't exist.
Well, maybe it does exist and everyone else is wrong. But I'm not the only one to have noticed this.
Ian, I'm sure
the filmmakers are powerfully aware of it.
Ian in Birmingham, dear Frank, the Bunnymen and Donny. I used to be a big football fan, got bored with it, but I'm really looking forward to Away Days. But any film with Cabaret Voltaire, Joy Division, The Mekons, The Cure, Gang of Four, Echo and the Bunnymen, Wire, The Jam, The Mekons, Teardrop Explodes, The Human League and Elvis Costello on the soundtrack must be good.
You said The Mekons twice there. Was there a reason for that?
He mentioned The Mekons twice, so I stuck true to the narrative of the email. David Parkinson on this email, hate to contradict the good doctor, but Away Days is set on the Wirral and not in Liverpool.
Yes, OK, fair enough.
And Birkenhead and not Liverpool.
Birkenhead.
Don't start your regional impression sequence or we'll end up with no listeners.
OK, it's just that's where I got married, so...
Does that give you the right to do a
rather
dodgy impression?
No, but listen, be very careful or I'm going to do an impression of the person who's meant to be the special guest on the...
On June the 17th, who's a very, very big star. And if he turned up, would be quite good. Although I've heard he can be quite prickly in interviews, so I might leave that to you. If that's okay. In fact, I've got a great story about how he dealt
although,
with...
Although, actually, can I just say on the
questioning...
on the subject of those locations...
Being interrupted
actually,
by your children, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, sorry, on the subject of those locations, actually, it does jump around a little bit, and the jury is out on exactly where it is. Anyway, carry on.
Mark is sounding slightly strange because he's in Japan, and James says, if the good doctor fancies stopping off in Hamamatsu, which is where James is... On the way to Kyoto, I'm hoping to watch the Jacques Demy classic The Umbrellas of Cherbourg at my local independent cinema on Saturday afternoon. What do you say, Mark?
Well, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is all right. I don't know that I'd go to the cinema to see it again.
What is the essential plot there? I've missed The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, the Jacques Demy classic, but...
It was re-released just... The BFI...
In brief?
Oh, I can't do a brief plot synopsis of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. All you need to know is that the BFI re-released, I think it was the BFI, re-released it a few years ago, and it was one of those things that, you know, everybody went, yeah, hooray, great.
Does it involve umbrellas?
Yes, and Cherbourg. Can we move on to Tormented, because we're going to run out of time otherwise.
Go on, then.
Okay, so Tormented, which, as you probably know, this is a strange period for British horror. British horror is a very distinctive thing. There are films which are distinctively British horror movies. And you think recently of movies like Eden Lake or Mum and Dad. And I wasn't a huge fan of Mum and Dad, but it was a quintessentially British horror movie. And it was a film that could only have really happened here. So what you have in the case of Tormented, and I am not, as you know, I'm not very televisual, but even I thought, oh, that looks very post-Skins. Of course, everybody says, oh, yeah, this is what it is. It's a post-Skins British version of the standard knockoff US high school slasher. You know the plot from all those US high school slashers is, basically, there's a bunch of jocks and a bunch of in guys, and they've all picked on some nerdy bloke who, at the beginning of the film, either is dying or is dead. And then, during the course of the movie, all the in guys and the jocks and the hip get picked off one by one, and it's always one of four things. Either A, the ghost of the nerdy guy who died because it was somehow their fault, either he killed himself because of them or they killed him, or it's the mother of the nerdy guy, if it's in the Jason Voorhees movies, or it's them themselves, it's the person themselves because they never really died, or it's all of the above, right? So we've all seen this in so many American movies. The difference here is transplanted over to England, and we get essentially the same plot, but playing out in what looks, for all the world, like a kind of, oh, let's take Skins and put it on screen. So, you're at high school, there's a nerd who is Darren Mollet, who, a.k.a. Shrek, who at the beginning of the movie, it opens on his funeral. The head girl at the school stands up and makes a speech and says, well, it's terrible, but he had loads of friends, at which point the geeky guy... Oh, E possibility. The geeky guy did it. Geeky guy stands up and said, no. He never had any friends. You were all horrible to him. And it was all your fault. And, you know, revenge is coming. And then what starts to happen is they start get mobile phone messages, apparently from the dead guy. Here's a clip.
Nah. Mullet is dead.
Which means...
You can't be sending me texts. I don't think you get signal up there, do you?
Well, I can't even get signal in the bugs.
Exactly.
Now, pretending to be Shrek, risen from the dead, ain't a bad guy.
Give me his phone, and we'll call it quits.
I haven't got his phone. Jason. Jason.
Jason.
You're only hurting yourself, mate.
It's from Mullet.
Do you remember when Alex Pettifer came on the show? When Stormbreaker came out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because he came in with Anthony Horowitz.
He came in with Anthony Horowitz, yes. And he was this really nice, you know, fresh-faced, sort of, you know, posh kind of, you know, kid, yes, who'd got this starring role in Stormbreaker, right?
He did nothing after that.
Well, he did a couple of things that weren't particularly memorable. He turned up in a couple of films as the posh, pretty, you know, young man about town. And it seems to me that he must have had a conversation with his agent, which he went, look, you know this whole thing about I'm posh and pretty. I really want to get beyond that. Do you think you could find me a movie in which I can get to be, you know, a little bit ghastly? And so they've gone off and found him this film in which it's like, yeah, get me something in which I swear a lot, and get me something in which I misbehave a lot, and get me something in which lots of bad stuff happens. And, of course, lots of bad stuff does happen in Tormented. And, of course, the baddest of the bad stuff that happens to him in a scene which reminds me of that... Do you remember that? Sorry, so I'm going to mention this since I'm in Japan. Do you remember in Basic Instinct, there's the gag in Basic Instinct about he got off before he got offed, which in Japanese was translated into he rose and then rose again. Well, that, essentially, is a very classy version of a very downmarket gag, which is the centrepiece of Away Days. And what you get, therefore, is the standard US thing played out in a British school in which a bunch of people get knocked off in sort of school-like ways. So one of them gets flicked to death by a wet towel, and one of them gets to death by pencil case, and another one's death by swimming pool. It's also other school-related incidents. And
flicked to death with a wet towel?
Yes.
You
I mean,
can't
that's
be killed by a wet towel flicking you.
Well, apparently, according to Tormented, you can. Yes, apparently, you can be flicked to death with it. Well, I'm sure if you tried hard enough, I'm sure it would be possible. But in a way, the flick to death by the wet towel thing is symptomatic of what my problem with Tormented is. There's loads of gory stuff in it, and I'm quite a fan of gory stuff, and the gore tends to be sort of fairly explicit. But on the other hand, it's all on the goofy side of explicit. And the thing with the film is, it seemed to me that it couldn't quite decide whether it wanted to be funny or whether it wanted to be a horror film. And as so often happens with horror comedies, it kind of ended up being neither. And I refer you back again to Sam Raimi in The Evil Dead. The Evil Dead or American Werewolf in London is another great example. It's very hard to get the combination of horror and comedy right. I mean, Sam Raimi always said that horror and comedy were very, very closely related. And when he was making The Evil Dead, he was effectively making The Three Stooges, but with blood and guts standing in for custard pies. In the case of Tormented, They think, on the one hand, that they want to have a kind of Friday the 13th straight-out horror movie, you know, a standard high school slasher movie, perfectly fine, nothing wrong with that. And there's enough sort of gruely gore in there to keep the gore fans happy. But the goofiness of it, the knowing goofiness of it, keeps undercutting any potential horror. But it's not funny enough to be an outright sort of barf fest. So you're left in this strange sort of netherworld in which I want the movie to be better than it is and I want to like it more than I do, but it keeps falling flat because it keeps sort of doing that schoolboy thing of going sort of sniggering up its sleeve and not really having the guts to be a full-blooded horror movie. And in the middle of it is Alex Pettifer storming around and you know, effing and blinding as if he's had a strop and told his agent that he wants to be in more grown-up movies. It's a 15 certificate, and there's a lovely thing on the BBFC website that says it contains a strong, it contains sequences of strong violence, but they're not dwelt on unduly, nor are they bloody enough to require the highest category. Other sequences of bloody or more gory violence are tinged with a comedic element that mitigates the horror considerably. And to me, that was the essence of it. Whenever there was any horror, it kept being considerably mitigated. And as somebody who doesn't like their horror to be considerably mitigated, I kept being a bit sort of, you know, what do you want? Do you want me to be scared or do you want me to laugh? And would you please make your mind up? Because if you're going to do it like that, I'm not going to do either of them. I mean, it's not without merit. And it's not, I mean, I'm sure there's a sort of 15-year-old teenage audience out there that are going to have a perfectly good time with it and recognise a couple of characters out of Skins, incidentally, and are going to laugh at the gory moments. But it's not coherent enough to make it anything more than just fluff.
Michael Shelton says, "Dear Stop It and Tidy Up, went to see the national premiere of Tormented last night in Birmingham, but was unable to give an objective review, as I spent half the film stunned that a zombie seemed to be running around my old school murdering all the bullies. In my 6 years at Bishop Vesey Grammar, which is, I imagine, where it was filmed, many a time did I imagine stringing up a few teachers and pupils. I didn't know you could get paid for the pleasure, however. Continual respect to the Quiffmeister,"
and also
Michael Shelton.
Since you've brought up the subject of zombie, I mean, it is a sort of laughable zombie. It's a kind of zombie that appears to have shambled off the set of Shaun of the Dead. But again, the real genius of Shaun of the Dead was that it was a proper comedy film that happened to have moments of extremely poignant horror. The moment when the guy says, "I don't know if I can kill my best friend and my mother in the same day," is actually oddly tear-jerking. That's a classy film, which this isn't.
Movie of the week, however?
Well, I would say Away Days, because it surprised me and I was impressed by it despite my preconceptions. If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes and the chance to let me know your opinions.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live